Although the Tibetan Book of the Dead is traditionally read in order to guide the spirit of the dead person, it is primarily meant to be studied and practiced during life, not only so that one will be able to remember it at the time of death, but because its teachings actually refer to this life just as much as they do to any future existence. Buddhism teaches that nothing is static or permanent. Life is a continuous flow of interconnected moments. The nature of each moment is determined by what has gone before, just as one's next birth is determined by one's actions during this lifetime. So we can say that life and death are actually both taking place at every instant. The word bardo means an intermediate state, a gap or period of suspension when one situation has come to an end and another has not yet developed. It occurs in the interval between two states of mind, as well as between states of existence, such as birth and death. Any everyday situation of hesitation or uncertainty, or of inner conflict between opposing emotions, contains characteristics of the intermediate state. So do those extremes of emotion when one is on the edge of complete exhaustion, or feels one is approaching the borderline of insanity. At such moments of concentrated energy, one may suddenly enter a neutral state in which one feels completely free, calm, and detached. This is an intuitive glimpse of the ground of being, the nature of mind itself. It is called dharmata, the essence of things as they really are. It is described as indivisible emptiness and luminosity. Just before death, a dying person's consciousness becomes progressively more and more detached from the external world and from the body, until it is completely concentrated within, and there is an experience of a sense of internal glow or luminosity. This is called the bardo of the moment before death. After death, the consciousness is freed from the limitations of the physical body and is able to perceive a subtle level of existence where everything manifests as sounds and colors instead of solid material forms. Underlying all these appearances is a luminosity, the light of reality, and if one can recognize that and merge with it, one reaches the absolute level of Dharmakaya. If one is unable to let go into that state, visions of the Buddhas and other divine beings appear, first in peaceful forms and then in wrathful forms, offering many different approaches to enlightenment. At the same time, our memories of the ordinary world of suffering, or samsara, also beckon us, appearing as paths of colored light leading us to future rebirth in one of the six realms of existence. Next come terrifying experiences of judgment by Mara, the Lord of Death, and the pursuit and torture by avenging demons. The fundamental teaching of the whole text is to recognize that these visions are the projections of one's own mind. As soon as one realizes this, one is liberated from the visions. Finally, if one has been unable to recognize this, one enters the bardo of becoming, the transition to a future birth in one of the six realms. Even at this point, there are still opportunities to recognize the luminosity, because the focus of the mind is concentrated by intense fear. Instead of escaping into a new form of existence, the consciousness in the bardo can stop and confront this fear, and so attain liberation from it. If this fails, the text gives instructions on choosing a new birth that will be of benefit to oneself and others. All these situations described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead can be seen as symbolic or visionary pictures of events and experiences in human life. For instance, even at the last minute, there is always the possibility of refusing to give in to anger or passion, refusing to be caught up in that world, and preventing the birth of some seemingly inevitable situation. The six realms of existence represent both the various states of mind into which our consciousness is continually reborn and the different ways of experiencing the world. They arise from the instinctive emotional reactions to the openness and brilliance of the luminosity. The realm of hell, the lowest of the six realms, is the most intense, dominated by aggression, hatred, and anger. Hell can be burning hot, an environment of claustrophobic terror, or icy cold, a frozen isolation that results from pride and resentment towards others. The realm of hungry ghosts develops from greed, a hunger that continually increases and can never be satisfied. Possession brings no pleasure to the hungry ghost, only searching and grasping matter, so there is a sense of endless frustration and disappointment, even though one is surrounded by food and wealth. The animal realm arises from ignorance. It is a deliberate turning away, playing deaf and dumb so as to avoid the brilliant light of reality. It can create a comfortable, predictable way of life, but one that is also very mechanical and without any sense of humor, unable to respond to the unexpected or the unknown. The human realm is based on passion and enjoyment. It contains qualities of exploration, striving, and creativity that may lead to success and fulfillment, but also suspicion and doubt that continually undermine the sense of achievement. The realm of the jealous gods is based on a fundamental sense of jealousy or envy, as though the very existence of others is a threat to one's own survival. Here, no relationship is possible without intrigue. One must always be on one's guard against hidden enemies and on the watch for opportunities to win, either by diplomacy or superior strength. The realm of gods develops from pride, an instinctive self-consciousness which arises when faced with the impersonal openness of the luminosity. It is the highest realm of self-development, pleasure, and peace, with the feeling that one is invincible and immortal. We can easily recognize in these six realms the familiar psychological states of daily life, but at the same time, we always possess within us inherent Buddha nature, the latent possibility of enlightenment, which appears as aspects of wisdom or enlightenment corresponding to our particular tendencies. In the intermediate state, they manifest as the five Tathagatas or Buddhas, inviting us to dissolve into the rays of light that stream out from their hearts. The five wisdoms are the liberated energy of enlightenment, but in samsara, they are distorted into the five negative emotions or poisons. They are also known as the five families, to which all living things belong. The first of the Tathagatas in the center of the mandala is Varochana, and his family is known simply as the Tathagata of Buddha family. It is associated with the basic poison of confusion or ignorance, which it deliberately ignores and out of which all the other poisons evolve. But Varochana also embodies the wisdom of Dharmadhatu, the limitless, all-pervading space in which everything exists as it really is, the truth that reverses ignorance. The second Tathagata is Akshobhya, in the eastern side of the mandala. He is the ruler of the Vajra family, whose poison is aggression or hatred. This is transmuted into the mirror-like wisdom, which reflects everything calmly and clearly. In the southern side of the mandala is Ratnasambhava, ruler of the Ratna family. Ratna means jewel, and in particular the wish-granting gem which magically grants all desires. So here the poison is pride, resulting from the possession of spiritual or material riches. Its antidote and corresponding wisdom is the wisdom of equality and equanimity. In the west is Amitabha, whose family is Padma, the lotus. The poison of this family is desire or passion, grasping hungrily at everything, and its wisdom is the wisdom of discrimination, which provides the coolness and carefulness that allows for passion to be transformed into compassion. Lastly, in the north is Amoghasiddhi, ruler of the Karma family. Karma means action and is symbolized by a sword or double vajra. Envy is the poison associated with karma, arising from the insatiable ambition that drives this kind of activity, while its enlightened aspect is the wisdom that accomplishes all actions. The Tathagatas embody the transcendent qualities of enlightenment, their absolute existence. They are united with their consorts, the fertile feminine energy, which completes them and allows them to manifest. They are attended by male and female bodhisattvas, which represent the principle of active engagement for the sake of all beings. At first, these deities appear in peaceful form. They simply reveal the existence of enlightenment, immovable and invincible, the beginningless and endless state of absolute peace. Such a pure, impersonal state may appear threatening as well as attractive, which leads us into the next vision, the Vidyadharas. The Vidyadharas are simply expressions of the same Buddha nature seen in a different light. They are the essence of communication, the divine form of the tantric guru, possessing power over the magical aspects of the universe. They combine elements of both the peaceful and wrathful deities. If we do not respond to the communication of the Vidyadharas, they become transformed into their wrathful manifestations, the Harukas. The basic qualities of the five families continue, but now their energy is expressed in a very dramatic and powerful way. This is the ruthless, unyielding quality of peacefulness, which does not allow any escape. Fundamentally, the quality of the five families is a peaceful state because it is completely stable and nothing can disturb it. The tremendous energy of that peaceful state now manifests itself as wrathful. It is often described as compassionate anger, anger without hatred. These transformations, too, have counterparts in our own lives. As their active energy increases, not only do the possibilities for insight increase, but also the possibility of danger. For instance, psychic experiences and the awareness of the magic of life belong to the realm of the Vidyadharas, while the activity of the Harukas might be felt as an accident or a sudden shock that wakes one up to reality. After the Harukas, a whole crowd of other fierce and terrifying deities appears, each symbolizing a specific quality of enlightenment and carrying out a particular function of the individual consciousness. Again and again, we are reminded that these visions come from our mind, and we need only recognize them as our own projections in order to be liberated from them. In the text, it says that all this is meant to remind the dead person of what he has already practiced during his life. But we can still use the essential principles of the teaching to help those who are not familiar with it by opening our minds to them and transmitting our own sense of warmth, stability, and confidence. If one is close to someone who is dying, it is very important to be truthful about what is happening, so that there is complete mutual trust, friendship, and communication. As the person's physical and mental condition deteriorates, he or she develops a higher awareness of the surrounding emotional atmosphere, so that one's own state of mind is extremely important and becomes part of the dying person. It is impossible to know what someone in the intermediate state is going through, or whether you are still having any real contact with a person. But the essential thing is to continue to provide this stable environment so that automatically the consciousness in the bardo will be attracted to that. When one listens to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, although all the symbolic details are significant, it is not necessary to analyze and remember them all in order to benefit from the text. All these details contribute to overwhelming emotional impressions. Just listening in a relaxed, open, and attentive state of mind will make us receptive to their inner meaning, and we will be able to recognize them as experiences in our own lives and understand their symbolism intuitively.